to Lower Columbia Sturgeon now, and Pat, I'll turn it over to you and Brad. Then we do have about six individuals that wish to comment.
Okay, I will try to make this expedient for you then so that we don't
spend too much time, which my boss says is challenging for me. Good morning or afternoon or whatever. The reason we're here today, right now, is to talk about an annual update of another policy, the Sturgeon policy, which is C3001. Some quick background really quickly on the populations. This really focuses on the Lower Columbia River population, which is below Bonneville. All those populations above Bonneville Dam are separate and different populations. So this is really focusing on what happens below Bonneville Dam. We, in the policy, were asked to cover multiple topics, and these are the seven topics that we're asked to cover when in that plan. The first three topics, we really can't provide any additional information because they're really pretty specific to fisheries and impacts from fisheries. So because of that, we don't have any updates since 2013. So we will focus on the four underlined and bold topics that we have there. The policy guidance, it began in March 1st, 2014, and one thing that has moved forward as part of this policy is that there is a sturgeon retention prohibition right now, so we're catch and release only for the entire Lower Columbia and its tributaries and the coastal areas that impact these same populations, and that began January 1st, 2014. One of the things that people always talk about when they talk about sturgeon is sea lions and the predation of sea lions. Here's a quick figure on sea lions, and what this shows is the bars show the predation by stellar sea lions, and the yellow line shows the number of stellar sea lions. You can see that in the last couple of years, the predation has gone down significantly, even though the population continues to grow. We really believe that the sturgeon may be redistributing themselves, and that may, in fact, be having some impact on productivity of this population over time, because this is all information from right below Bonneville Dam, which is considered historically the prime spawning area for white sturgeon in the Lower Columbia River. Here's a quick look at the increase in, these are California sea lions, and what's happened down in the Lower Columbia. This is a picture from Astoria, and you see in 2014 there were 1,400 of them. 2015 there were 2,300 of them. So there is significantly more sea lions in the river than once was. We do annual population estimates, and we've changed the methodology over time. But as we did that, we did both methodologies concurrently so that we know that this creates a long-term data set for us. Now, this is the legal size population, and this is probably our best piece of data for sturgeon in the Columbia River. It dates back to 1988 or farther back, but that's what we're showing here. And you can see that the adult abundance in 2012 was at a fairly low level at 7,200. In the last 5 years, it's increased and doubled to almost 150,000, and that's where you see that blue dot on the end of that. So, and that population size of adult abundance is consistent with sizes where we've had fisheries on this population in the past. I will move on to the next one. The other piece, another key piece of information, is juvenile production. How effectively are these fish spawning, and are they producing juveniles? And that's what this graph looks at. The blue bar across the top is from the Lower Columbia River, and the yellow bar is across the Willamette River. This data has far more uncertainty than the previous data I showed you because of its short-term data set. We've only been doing the Columbia since 2004 and the Lower Willamette since 2010. The Columbia, the last 5 years, have had very poor production levels. The Willamette in the last 5 years has been fairly consistent and fairly stable. What we don't know about the Willamette is what was it doing before. So has the Willamette grown from where it once was to compensate? We don't know that information because we just don't have historic. The other thing we don't have is what did juvenile production look like back in the 1970s, 60s, 80s when this population was extremely productive and producing large numbers of fish. Another key thing we've done is we've developed a set line fishery where we go out and we have research set lines to capture fish, and we do a length frequency based on the fish captured in those set line fisheries. This graph really depicts it, and what you really want to focus on is the shape of the graph to the left of the yellow line, the yellow line on the left side, the 38-inch fork length. You can see on the top graph in 2012, it spikes fairly high. It has some fairly high proportions in there. Look at the graph below on 2015. It's much flatter, and it doesn't have near as high. What that represents is that the subyearling portion, or these juvenile younger fish, are representing a smaller proportion of the population than used to occur. And that means there is, over time, going to be less recruitment into that legal size abundance that I just mentioned earlier than there has been in the past. So in summary, we have five key metrics that we tend to look at when we look at sturgeon, and certainly these aren't all the metrics. This doesn't account for an improved smelt population that provides more forage and more predation for sea lions and those kind of things. But these are five that we think are fairly important. Legal size abundance is increasing, as I talked about. Length frequency and the rest of those are decreasing, so they're more negative. One thing to think about when you look at this is, what's the uncertainty around these estimates? And the most certain of these estimates is the legal size abundance. It's a long data track that has a consistent methodology that we can use from year to year. In contrast to that, look at the sea lion abundance. We know about mortality rates and predation rates near Bonneville Dam, but we really don't know about predation rates in the rest of the river. We know some abundance levels, and those are more recent, but we really don't know what's happening in the majority of the river with regard to sea lion. And the other three indices fall somewhere in the middle of that. The length frequency, it's a short data set, but it's a well-done data set, and its precision has increased significantly from when it was introduced in 2010 to where it is now. So not all these are created equal when you look at these arrows. So think about that when you think about whether we're making a decision. I do want to talk a little bit about fishery. In 2015, predecessors of mine came before you and talked about possible fisheries, and we talked about some of the considerations of those fisheries. Some key things are, since we've implemented this retention restriction, effort has dropped by over 90% in the estuary and 80%, 82% upstream of the estuary, so we're not getting much participation in these catch and release fisheries. The legal population was large enough to harvest, be considered for harvest at that time, and the options that we looked at focused at a 6% impact on the legal size rate. Some of the fishery discussions that continued last year was WDFW did engage in negotiations with ODFW at the direction of you, the commission. And we talked about a harvest rate of less than 6% on the legal size population. And we focused on really getting anglers back into the lower river, especially the estuary, which has been extremely hard hit by the retention restriction. The negotiations concluded with no real movement forward in any direction, and so we're back here again today. I know this issue came up yesterday at the commission meeting, and there was some interest in me providing some information regarding potential fisheries or something to consider for 2016. So for 2016, as I talked about, four of the five metrics we look at the fisheries don't suggest that the population is improving. However, on the other side, the legal size population has doubled in the last 5 years since 2012. We did have advisor meetings. The sport advisory group was somewhat split. There was some retention support for a retention fishery in that group and some support for not retention fisheries. The commercial advisor was fairly well consistent, and they like to consider continuing the retention band in the lower Columbia. We do have an example of a fishery we modeled. We actually modeled this fishery last year, and this still applies. The data's changed a little bit, but it doesn't significantly change what we'd look at when we think about a fishery. We'd really focus on a fishery that would be, this fishery would focus on an impact of 6% or less on the equivalent broodstock population. So when we evaluate the fishery, what's it do to the broodstock? Not what does it do to the legal adult size or the legal size or juvenile size. What does it do to the broodstock, those fish that we need to perpetuate this species? We talked about a narrow size slot limit. Maybe something more similar to the commercial size limit. We talked about a 30-day fishery in May-June timeframe. Not all of it could occur in June. Not all of it could occur in May. We'd have to split that time frame to make sure the catch rate's adequate. We talked about expecting to generate about 30,000 angler trips, and we talked about maintaining 20% of that harvest be through the commercial fishery as per the current commission policy. We did do some modeling. And we did. And the key here is look at the trend, not necessarily look at the exact outcome. The abundance, that's a modeled abundance. So what happens between now and then? Can I say that we'll get 6,000 fish in 2020? I can't guarantee that. There's a lot of things that impact that. What you really want to look at is look at the red line, which is where you have no harvest, and then look at the yellow line, which is where you have a 5% harvest rate, which is what we're talking about. You can see there's very, very little difference between those two lines. So we're comfortable that in the long term, any fishery that we implement or suggest or recommend regarding less than a 6% impact rate is going to have only a very minor impact on the resulting broodstock at the end of the day, which is really the key to manage this long-life fish. And I will say one of the things to think about is, remember, when we look at this, this is really built on fish that are adult broodstock spawning size now. It doesn't really take into account how many fish are going to recruit into that. What you're seeing in that time frame is really what's going to happen to the existing broodstock. And with that, I conclude my presentation, and thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I have one.
Okay.
The predation of white sturgeon going from 3,000 to almost zero in 4 years, and dispersal was one. You said that yesterday it was mentioned that because smelt were coming back, maybe they weren't. But that seems pretty dramatic in 4 years.
It is pretty dramatic. Smelt certainly could be one of those things because the fish are more attracted to the smelt. And I'll let Brad add more after I complete. But dispersal could be another one. These fish do need to survive, and they're going to figure out a way to do that. We've seen more fish in tributaries than used to be. We've seen more fish in the Willamette. We see fish in different locations of Bonneville Dam where they're much closer to the dam than they ever once used to be, hiding from where the sea lions can't get to them. So they are moving around. And in fact, near the end of the sport fishery, we saw significantly increased catch rates of large fish in the estuary and the Willamette, while the catch rates of large fish in the Bonneville area were decreasing. So we think there is some dispersal going on. Brad, do you have more to add there?
And the one other piece that I would add is I think we're dealing with a much smaller adult or broodstock population.
Okay. Yes.
A little bit more information about dispersal. As I understand, these fish have very particular brooding needs. So as they disperse, are they dispersing into areas where they can brood and spawn, rather?
I think they're going to seek out areas that tend to meet those needs, but all in all, I think it's in more marginal areas, and I suspect that if that's what's occurring, the level of production is going to suffer.
Thank you.
And logic would then say that if smelt are not the major factor, those sea lions, if they're not getting the sturgeon, may just go back home.
So sea lions, yes, they will go back home, or they will turn to other food sources too.
You seen that?
Well, the smelt for sure in the last 2-3 years with those extremely large smelt runs, We've seen sea lions harvest, eating those smelt at really high paces. You've seen rafts of sea lions resting out front of the Cowlitz River after they're done feasting on the sea lions on the smelt. So certainly that we have seen. I've heard anecdotal information of sea lions taking crab out of crab pots and those kind of things that are removed. So there's different places they will go to find. They're pretty omnivorous critters, so there may be a lot of food sources out there that we don't recognize.
Numbers are still going up. Something's keeping them in town. So.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. And I would add that I think sea lions that are spread throughout the rest of the river are taking advantage of whatever sturgeon are present, not just right at the base of Bonneville Dam.
Interesting. Any other comments or questions?
Yes, I do have another one. So on your slide that talks about the drop in participation in 2014 due to the no retention. Is that a drop in all angler activity in the area, or do these anglers come out and fish for other stocks?
That piece of data is specific to anglers targeting sturgeon in the estuary. In fact, the reduction was over 95% if you look at the key May-June timeframe.
So is that a drop in overall angler activity? I mean, are sturgeon fishers only fishing for sturgeon, or will they go out for other? I mean, I'm trying to understand the true economic impact on the communities.
I'm not sure I can speak completely to that, but in late May and June, sturgeon presence in the estuary bumps up, and that's generally what is drawing most people to those communities down there.
Thank you.
So the thing we can say is they're not going to those same communities to fish for another species because mm-hmm. that other species isn't attracting them there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. And another very interesting presentation. And we do have public comment. And again, I will call you up two at a time, please. Bryce Devine and Harry Barber, please.
Good afternoon again. I'll try to speak faster this time. Maybe I can get through. I bring a somewhat of a consensus. The commercial industry is really not asking for any harvest this year at all. We're entitled to 20%, but we're not asking for a harvest. I spent the last couple days reading some sturgeon studies, and one of the most interesting things I found was that in Russia, when they're trying to spawn these fish for hatchery, they chill the water to 4 degrees centigrade, which is about 40 degrees. So I wonder if maybe our reproductive problem might have something to do with water temperature. I also have a study here of a short-term mortality study that was done in Astoria by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, where they, over 3 years, captured 183 sturgeon in gill nets and put them in net pens for 2 days. Mortalities was zero, no mortalities in the study at all. And the cortisol studies haven't been linked to failure of spawn or reabsorption of their eggs or whatever. In fact, we've been fishing for quite a few years, generally not in the time frame of spawning, and we've had some very productive years during those times. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello again.
Kent Martin, please. Go ahead.
I sent you my prepared comments. I hope you read them. I will sort of ad lib from the slides and the report that was handed out at the advisory meeting. I'm 73 years old. I fished sturgeons for 45 years. I dearly love to fish sturgeons some more, but I strongly recommend against it. I think this stock is in a world of hurt. Let me start with adult abundance. If for the third year in a row it's below the conservation threshold as stated in the plan, the threshold is 3,900. The population estimate is 3,039. The plan states that the Sturgeon Management Technical Committee should meet and recommend countermeasures to increase the population. As far as I checked with Oregon, the committee has not yet met. I hope this commission will direct its staff to meet with Oregon and study this issue and hopefully come up with some countermeasures. So that's the adult problem. If you go to the second one, the recruitment index this last year was 0.5. It's the lowest on record, the poorest productivity on record, and we don't know why. So again, I would hope that the committee would, technical committee would take a look at that. What really concerns me is the frequency length distribution. The plan says that 95% of the population should be juveniles. In 2010, 91% were juveniles. This year, 69% were juveniles. 60% triggers the conservation threshold. The plan also says if you're on a trajectory to the conservation threshold limit, you should take action now. So you've got two huge red flags requiring action. And I think it's foolish to sit here and argue about should we harvest or should we not harvest. That's not the issue. The issue is how do we recover our rootstock? These fish are a lot like a red snapper in the ocean. I mean, they don't spawn until they're 25 years old. Management action that you take today isn't going to really have any impact for another 15 to 20 or 25 years. They're very different than salmon or steelhead where you're looking at 4 or 5 years. Sea lion abundance is a huge problem. I fish a lot below Bonneville Dam. In the fall up there, we were catching Chinook. In late October, there were about 10 or 12 sea lions around Stellars. The salmon are all gone. The steelhead are all gone. They're not going over the dam now, but guess what? The sea lions are still there, and they got basically one thing to eat, and that's sturgeon. So I think that our overrice population is just been hammered. And you asked the question, Larry, about the observed predation went from 3,000 to zero. Could be because they're not there. Could just be because they're not there. And they only spawn in one place. They only spawn in the 8 miles and the fast water and the large cobble below Bonneville Dam. They don't go up to Sandy. They don't go to the Clackamas. Spawn over there. I personally think we are maybe at or past the tipping point in this population.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Right now, my understanding is that there is a catch and release fishery allowed, and so I'd be interested to hear your perspective on whether that should continue.
I think any handle of an oversized root fish will stress it, will raise a cortisol level. I personally fish oversized fish 1985, 86 out of Camas. And you know what I found? My friend Dr. Tom Wolford and I fished them quite intensively. And you go out Monday and you catch a couple oversized sturgeon. You go out Tuesday, you catch the same one again. They'd have certain marks on their head or their face. So recapture is a huge problem. I think it's a huge problem in gillnets, and I think it's a huge problem for sports. And I personally recommend that we just don't touch these fish. We just leave them alone.
Thank you. Butch Smith, please. Smith. We got a Smith. Butch, please.
Yeah. Kent. Commissioners, my name is Kent Martin. I'm a commercial fisherman from Skamakaway, Washington. I wanted to go through just a little bit of history with regard to this sturgeon. And we keep saying, well, it's all our fault. This all came to light when staff biologists began finding oversized sturgeon carcasses with 30, 40, 50 hooks in their guts, dead. Of course, these mortalities had nothing to do with the gillnet fishery, but that's why a lot of some of those sanctuaries originally got instituted. There is a fisherman here, I believe, who got here too late to sign up, the name of Tim Hoiker. He gillnetted sturgeon for broodstock for a private facility, but with the presence of the state, and they would fish 12-inch mesh, took large broodstock sturgeon, opened them up, took the eggs, sewed them back up, and dumped them back overboard. I think the idea of the cortisol relationship is pretty poorly understood, and some of the people that are screaming for don't touch a sturgeon, I think, have other things very much in mind with regard to eliminating other fisheries. And my sea lion predation is the major issue, I think. But my final comment, I want to just talk for a minute about these seine fisheries that seem to have captured. We're talking an extremely capital-intensive operation. We're talking $10,000 a year just for insurance to cover, just for the insurance to cover a four-man crew, pollution, everything that goes with that. We're talking way over, probably $150,000 to gear up for one of these fisheries. And I guess I'm going to be report the findings of my fellow fishermen. Most of them are pretty cynical that you're not going to provide them enough fish to make this work. Who wants to cough up $150,000 on the off chance that maybe they'll be allowed to make that thing economically viable? It's a huge issue. The other one that I hear is about something about a seine fishery in the Zone 4-5, where we're gill netting now, and that's an extremely clean fishery. It's, my God, it's been studied to death, you know. But that's an area where there's a lot of recreational boaters, sailboaters, water skiers. If you start with a commercial seine fishery in that Zone 4-5 area in the Portland-Vancouver area, you're going to get somebody killed. And the first question is going to be, why was that guy out there? And the second question is going to be, who put him out there? If there's one thing that I've noticed is there's a lot of people out there that think nothing of buzzing around at 40 or 50 miles an hour. And this is a recipe for a major social disaster. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Robert Sudan, please.
I'm going to pass, Mr. Chairman. The price
can't cover my... Okay. Thank you, Robert. Ed Wickersham. And Butch...
Good morning, Commission. My name is Butch Smith. I am president of the Elwaco Charter Association. I also am a port commissioner out of Elwaco, Washington. And I sit on the Salmon Advisory Subpanel to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which I am chairman of. Also, various sport advisory groups. I'm here today to encourage and support Patrick Frazier's last slide on a small conservative harvest on fishing this year. I wish I would have brought that picture that I've drug up here for 3 years, and I wish I'd have brought those stacks of letters that I brought up here for 3 years since we've been through this on the devastation that the lack of sturgeon retention has caused my communities, Astoria, Elwaco, Chinook, on the coastal communities. I have a picture that shows a Memorial Weekend Saturday in the boat basin of Elwaco, Washington, completely empty. The other commissioners have seen it. It's not a fictitious. It's just I just didn't drag it with me. I didn't think it was germane to the conversation. I wasn't. We started this process. We were at 65,000 fish three or four years ago. I like Patrick's number better at 7,200. It sounds better going to 150,000, but it was around 65,000. And you didn't see me up here begging for a fisheries or asking for a fisheries at that level. And I thought it was good, but the keeper population at about 150,000, it's time. I mean, we've had those populations at that size years ago that we were probably harvesting a little bit too much, but up to 40%, and we're asking for a 7 to 9% harvest on that stock. The conservation plan calls for 13%, and we're not asking for that. We're asking for something smaller. We need to get some people back in our communities. 95% is just absolutely unacceptable. State budgets are falling in fisheries, bringing fishers, sport fishers back into the younger generations, and we're losing all that. If I thought for a second that we were hurting this population in any way, shape, or form, I would not be sitting here. I didn't invent the sturgeon fisheries, nor I will claim fame to, but you didn't see very many boats when I started sturgeon fishing out of Elwaco in 1982. And it was me. And I took a lot of, in fact, it was so new down there, I took a lot of the biologists from Oregon and some from Washington that used to tag fish on my boat. So I encourage you this year to support a small conservation-minded harvest. The estuary also has the luxury of having a migrating population of fish. Our bank account fish. We're not asking you to open up the whole states of Oregon and Washington, where the Columbia River sturgeon migrate from the Fraser River clear down to the Sacramento River. So I would encourage and hope you would support this this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And Ed, you're the last one.
That's a dubious distinction. Again, thank you all, Mr. Director, Chairman Smith, Commissioners. Just a few brief comments. I would say follow the data. This population is sour, and really, when we look at it today, if you compare it what it was 15 or 20 years ago, it's abysmal. And we're talking about putting stress on this population that 4 out of 5 metrics say it is sour. This is a time to stick with the plan. As a sports fisherman and somebody who's fished sturgeon a bit, I don't like to be up here saying we need to stick with non-retention. But right now, let's say the data for some reason is wrong. Well, okay, a couple of years down the line, it'll show up and we've lost a couple of years of fishing. With the age of these fish and how long it takes for those young of the year to move into that broodstock area, we could lose decades. You know, and so I just again say, you know, continue non-retention. And I'd also suggest that with a population like this, we should be terminating all stress we can control. And that means hook and release fisheries and do everything we can to reduce the handle of oversize by commercial or recreational fisheries. And so with that, I thank you very much. I want to say that the commission has been the leader on this. I wonder where we would have been had we taken some of these recommendations from staff 5 years ago. And I want to thank you very much. The other thing I want to ask, please, Chairman Smith and Director Unsworth, could you please increase the pay for volunteers? Okay.
Charity begins at home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think we have time to... Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, does staff expect us to give some guidance at this point? Pat, is that what we're supposed to be doing right now?
So, excuse me for not including that in the presentation earlier. Yes, in order to implement any kind of fishery, if we were to so desire, we would need to engage the Oregon Commission and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife folks to do that. So what we're asking of you is, should we engage in those discussions? Not necessarily go set a fishery or agree to a fishery, but should we initiate discussions regarding this fishery with the ODFW and see what is a possibility or isn't a possibility? So that is our request of you. Thank you.
Well, then let me ask you to elaborate a little bit on why when we went through this last year, and I know there were strong mixed feelings last year about where we were and whether we should have this small impact, right? So how did the conversation go with Oregon, and how did it end up that there was no fishery?
So being back to the agency after being gone for a bit, I'm going to ask for some help from a colleague of mine, Guy Norman. I think he can answer that. He was the one involved in those discussions.
Okay. I knew I'd get the call on that one. Chairman Smith, Commissioner Wecker, so we did go back to the Oregon staff. I believe we met with this commission in April. And then presented it to the Oregon staff and asked them to ask their commission if they're interested in further staff discussions for a fishery. Oregon Commission did not take it up. They did not give that direction to their staff. And so at that point in time, we were not in a position to continue to pursue it.
Any other thoughts?
Well, we need to speak up, give some guidance.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you look like a pregnant pause there.
I think we've seen enough and since our presentation in April and today to move ahead and advise staff on whether or not we believe as a commission that we should have a fishery on this sturgeon. And I'm prepared to move that we suspend or continue with the non-retention of the sturgeon fishery in the Lower Columbia.
Your thoughts?
He made a motion.
Oh yes. Yeah.
So can I have a clarification of what that non-retention means? Yes. Does that mean catch and release or no fishery whatsoever?
I would still support a catch and release fishery.
Okay. I'll second it for purposes of discussion.
Okay. Okay. Motion's been made and seconded. Further.
Needed discussion.
Yeah, further. That was the word I was looking for. Further discussion. Yes.
Larry, do you want to? I'll be brief. Really a difficult situation here to try and figure out. And I'm very sympathetic to small communities that Mr. Smith spoke about and how difficult it is when things dry up. So I guess I'm leaning towards no fishery, but I want to entertain. I guess I'd like to know before I make that statement in final form that what Oregon's intent is. I'd like to know what they're talking about doing. My guess is they're going to say no. So our discussion may not have any value whatsoever. So I guess having said that, I haven't said anything. But
when you say Oregon will say no, are they you're saying they'll say no to a fishery or
yes?
All right, they would be in support of what we're talking about.
I mean, what is your rearview mirror about what Oregon's staff and commission are going to do, would do?
Well, Commissioner Carpenter, what in just preliminary discussions with the Oregon staff this year, we haven't heard any aggressive pursuit of a fishery from the Oregon staff. In terms of the commission and their director, I think that's a bit of an unknown at this point. And so I guess if indeed this commission had any interest whatsoever pursuing those discussions, I think we would start with the staff and then ask them if they want to move that on and see what the litmus test for their commission is. Hopefully in their next commission meeting, I guess next month, that's probably what we would try and.
Yeah, I spoke with one of their commissioners, and this was in an informal way, but he indicated that he would follow our lead.
There's several down on that end.
Yeah, let me say a couple things here. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. There are 26 or 27 species of sturgeon worldwide. The IUCN, International Union for the Conservation of Nature, lists 24 of them as either endangered or threatened. They have different categories. They don't call it that, but they view the sturgeon populations worldwide in really deep trouble. We've got four of the five indicators showing that this population's in trouble. And I could not, in good conscience, support any kind of handling or harvest of sturgeon in the Lower Columbia River, because the white sturgeon is the last large remaining population of sturgeon of a single species left in the world. And I just can't bring myself to support any kind of a fishery or handle. That's my opinion.
What was your comment on the catch and release fishery? Did you?
I can't support a catch and release fishery.
I just want to make sure I heard you.
Go ahead, Jim. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
There again, our part of the world, we get some really good sturgeon and have lived with catch and release forever. I guess my question to you, because I've heard a comment, and it was in somebody's comment that catch and release down here was just a license to steal. How bad do people get tattooed when they get caught? Because I know up home, I think it's a social deal. Nobody ever does it because it's just so taboo, because it's such a precious resource to go out and catch a 12-foot sturgeon that, I mean, if you were to get caught doing that or brag about doing it, somebody'd wring your neck. So, but what is a penalty down here?
No one.
Commissioner Holtzmiller, I don't know specifically what the penalty. You're referring to illegally keeping a
sturgeon. Yeah, on a catch and release deal. Yeah. Because there again, I can see Dave's point. Yeah, we've lived with catch and release. That's just part of the world. And there again, you get people out, get to use a resource. People are really careful with the sturgeon in our part of the world because they know how they are. But if people are used to keeping them, if they were to catch one, is it a very stern fine or is it just...
Commissioner Holtzman, it's a significant fine. I just don't know what the amount is. I may, in terms of the catch and release issue, if I may. I think the biggest issue that our biologists had associated with catch and release was in that spawning area, handling oversized fish during the period when they're either staging to spawning or spawning or recovering from spawning, which we've defined as the month of April on into August. So what we did over a series of years was create a sanctuary where we eliminated catch and release, any target sturgeon fishing in that critical area during that critical time. That did a world of difference in terms of oversize handle in the fishery. We went from about 5,000 handle per year. In fact, the fishery was promoted, the catch and release of oversized fish, down to about 100 a year that are incidentally handled to salmon. So, at least from our perspective, that was the biggest issue that needed to be identified. We now have a 9-mile sanctuary from April through August, and we think that is, certainly even given the situation we have right now with this reduced productivity and concerns about the brood stock size, we think that was a major step in terms of conservation.
Say I support Commissioner Mankin's position and statement.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Just a point of clarification, Commissioner Grable. Your motion is limited to, and I think this discussion is limited to Lower Columbia. We're not talking about
right.
Upper Columbia.
Sturgeon.
I just want to make this sure. I supported the idea of moving forward with a small fishery as proposed by staff, and it did not go anywhere with Oregon. Kind of, I think the indication is that they probably won't entertain it. After thinking about this, hearing more staff presentations, looking at the indicators, 4 out of 5 are pointing downward. Notwithstanding some of the protections that the department has implemented with respect to the catch and release fishery, I too support. I'm in line with Commissioner Mankin, where I think we need to send a strong signal to all citizens, all users, that if we're not allowing this small-scale fishery, then we're really concerned about the stock, and we are. We shouldn't allow any handling, so I agree with Commissioner Mankin.
Hearing that, I'd like to offer an amendment to the motion, and that is that we support no fishery, no white sturgeon fishery in the Lower Columbia. Another point to that is we've heard that the catch and release fishery is not really used, so why open a catch and release and further harm the fish, or potentially harm the fish? So that's my offered amendment.
Is there a second?
Yeah, need a second.
I second.
Okay. The amendment's
What did I do?
What did I do now?
I think we got a vote on the motion.
Okay.
No,
yeah,
you can do that.
Yeah. No,
I mean, you're not making a rule. Yeah. And sort of the scope.
I'm wondering been taken out.
You said guidance to the Department of Fisheries. You don't want us with the key guys.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Yeah. Do I have to say that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we're doing is sending, by this motion and whatever the resulting vote is, we're sending guidance to the department that we do not want a sturgeon fishery.
Yeah, we're not creating a law.
Right, we're not.
Yeah. And that's helpful. Is a rule change like that is in compact waters, we would also need to go and coordinate that piece with
this
Oregon.
Is guidance. Guidance. Okay. Okay, so we need to vote on the amendment. On the amendment
first,
Okay.
So it's been seconded. Any further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, then. All of those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes.
So
the main motion.
Okay.
Yeah, the main motion.
So now the motion has been
sort of
made
vacated.
And seconded, and we've had further discussion, right? So all of those in favor of the main motion with the amendment that was passed, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment, or the main motion passes. It's getting to be a long day here. I hope that gives you a little help.
Yeah, thank you.
And so now you can talk to the colleagues and our colleagues in Oregon, say that they said they would follow, at least one said he would follow our lead. We're leading here. all right, with that, I will bring to a close and adjourn the Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting for the 23rd of January.